Blog Talk Radio. All too often these days, the factory whistle is falling silent in America. But there is a way to get American workers back to work. Start buying more American-made products. Now, a Michigan-based company is leading the way in this movement to strengthen our economy. It's called AmericanMadeProducts.com. AmericanMadeProducts.com is more than a way to purchase American-made products online quickly and securely. It's a way to get our economy moving in the right direction. Go online or call and speak to a live customer service representative. AmericanMadeProducts.com, a family company based on the belief in the American worker and the quality of American-made products. If you're an American manufacturer, big or small, and would like your products on our site, contact us. We add products daily. Tell your family, tell your friends, tell your employer about AmericanMadeProducts.com. Yeah, yeah. Visit, shop.
It's going to be your last show if you can't make it on time. It's all yours. Go. People in the chat in the switchboard, push one if you want to say anything. Dick is on with you, Scott. It's all yours.
All right. Hi, Dick. How are you doing?
Hi, Scott.
Well, I was trying to get an update from Brian Keller as far as how it's going. He was trying to run into some of the IEB down there. They missed Cindy Estrada. Other than that, he's down there, and he's trying to get his name out to people, and he's inside the building, which is a good thing.
Well, anybody can get inside the building.
Right.
It's not a matter of getting into the building. It's a matter of getting into the room where the convention is.
Right, right. And I think he's going to be in the gallery, so he'll be a spectator in it.
Well, we'll see.
If he gets down there all week.
I hope he gets in, because he really needs to sit there and watch how that thing works.
Right.
Everything up to now has just been his suppositions.
Right.
And I agree, they ought to. I think I put a post on the Facebook page. I think what the UAW do is they ought to live stream that convention on their Facebook page.
Right. Right.
I don't know why they don't. Well, we know why they don't do it. But the fact that Brian gets in doesn't do anybody else any good. Because all they're going to hear is what Brian thinks he saw.
Right.
But if they would live stream that thing, then maybe we wouldn't have so many ignorant remarks about the convention on the Facebook pages, and people could understand what's going on, the reality of it.
Right. Right. Well, I think this is the most detrimental moment in the UAW with what happens at this convention.
The most detrimental moment?
Because this is going to set the stage, this is going to set the stage going into bargaining next year.
Well, that's true, but then again, in a 2011 agreement, before they ratified it, I said that the 2011 agreement was setting the stage for where we are today.
Yes.
And that's exactly what happened. And now we don't have to worry about what's going to come in the next contract, because they're doing it right now.
Right, right. It's I don't know. It's disheartening to see what's going on.
Don't forget, Scott, where this whole thing started in the 2011 agreement was when they had that special agreement to build a subcompact car somewhere in General Motors. 6 months after the contract, they said, "Oh, guess what? We're going to do it at Orient." And it's the same lie that they put out about Saturn. We're going to build a subcompact car competitively. Well, they didn't. They built a medium-sized car at Saturn. And what they did at Orion then was they brought the Sonic that had been being built in Korea for almost 5 years and shipped it over in cardboard and wooden crates and all as kit cars, and they put them together other than the body stampings in the Orion plant, and half the material was run by Link. People are screaming about, oh, they're outsourcing half our material. That happened at Orion. Half the material was given to Marty Maroon's company, Link, and the body shop was given to Oakland Stamping, and they brought them in the plant, painted a yellow line around a huge area of the plant. They had their own skill trades, their own production people, their own high-lows, and Oakland Stamping provide the sheet metal for the Sonic. But everything that went inside the sheet metal, including complete engines and transmissions ready to go, came from Korea, and they built kit cars. So Orion is where this started, but nobody was looking when it happened. And that happened 6 months into the 2011 agreement. So I don't know why people are saying, oh, they're now they want to outsource half a material. No, not now. In 2011 that started. And that was all done out of cooperative operating agreements. So what they what they did then, they got us pregnant with the idea to see if people would go nuts, and they didn't. Now that none of you work for General Motors Company anymore. You don't. Madison's plant don't. Flint Engine doesn't. Lordstown
General Motors
doesn't.
LLC. Right.
General Motors legal companies. You don't work for General Motors Company anymore. What you are doing is all collective bargaining agreements have successor language. If somebody buys your company and you're organized under the GM agreement, you will continue to be covered by the GM agreement until that agreement expires. The question is what is your agreement in your plant going to look like come the next contract? Because you don't work for General Motors Company anymore.
Right.
I mean, you have your pension plan. They can't take that away from you. But that's about all. When you retire, you'll be in the VEBA. But the only people going in the VEBA are the current retirees and those of you that are still grandfathered into the defined benefit pension plan. So the question becomes is, who will the contract, what will a contract be at Metal Fab, at Engine, at the truck plant, at Orion? Will they be the German model? Will each plant will have their own freestanding agreement under an umbrella contract like they do? And don't forget what Bob King said, I don't see why the German model won't work for the Detroit 3. We already got it. The UAW GM Council is essentially a supervisory board. The GMS committee is what you work under. You heard me say it on this show 100 times. You guys don't work under the GM agreement. You work under the GMS agreement. So now the question is, they're already doing what they're going to negotiate in 2019. It is like watching a short comedy in the old movies where you saw one movie, saw a comedy, and then saw another one. You guys like you are fine. But where will the Tier 2s be? Where will the people who hired in after 2007 be? What will those contracts look like? How will they operate? Only they know. And they know now. The things they're doing now are what's going to be in the next agreement. It sounds crazy, but that's exactly what's happening.
Gotcha. Now, here comes the Works Council. I'm just saying, it's
it's not a matter. You've already got, Scott, in your local, you have a UAW GM council, and you also have a GMS committee, which are the children of the one that exists at Solidarity House, right?
Correct.
And who populates those two committees in your local? The shop committee.
Correct.
And who is their consultant?
The chairman.
No.
Or the GMS.
The Doc 46 GMS guy. The
right.
Doc 46
right.
GMS guy, if they want him to be. Don't you guys read the highlights or the contract?
Yes, I did. Yes.
You have essentially within the national labor, within our labor laws, as you just got done saying, you have shapes and forms of a supervisory board and a works council in your plant today. Now, are they going to further empower those committees? You already have language in the national agreement that says the plant manager and the chairman or their representatives have the responsibility for efficiency and behavior of employees. That's black letter print contract. I don't know how the hell a union, I don't care who in a union, is responsible for any dues-paying member's behavior. We only had that at Saturn. We had that at Saturn. And we had a disciplinary program that went with it called a consultation process, separate and apart from the grievance procedure. Nothing new here. We've essentially got a kind of a model of the European labor laws that were passed after World War II that created the supervisory board and the plant works council. You've got the bargaining committee sits on the UAW GM council locally, and they are the oversight of GMS. They are the GMS committee at the local union. And there are people in the GM department staff. There's probably an AD who's got GMS, and that's who the chairman contacts for issues on GMS. And some AD is communicating to them on the UAW GM council. Now, Cindy said when he did the Lordstown agreement, if you really read her letter, she said, we brought in the local and regional people on the Lordstown and Orion deal after they made the decision. She tried to make it sound like those local people were involved in that. They were not. If you read that carefully, she doesn't say they were involved in it. They hauled them down
no.
and said, this is the way it's going to be.
Right. Correct.
You want to complain? How long do you want to hold your job? Go make this happen. That's why they were there. So all this has come to pass now, going way back to what King said. We can't have what's in the European labor law, but we can have a version of it, and we've got it. We've got it. And it's your bargaining committee that is the collective voice for cooperative operating agreements that may come down. And don't forget, your chairman could be signing MOUs today. You'll never know about it because they don't have to tell you about it.
Right.
Mike Bennett was doing that back in 1986. When I got down there in 93 or 94, there are almost 3,000 of them that had been signed.
Well,
so you've got a combination of a variation of a theme on the German, on the European Works Council law, and the stuff that went on at Saturn. Now, they may well provide you with that consultation process, which is a disciplinary process that does control behavior of workers. In the consultation process, in the little gray book of 29 pages, the first thing you read was the Saturn philosophy statement. Your team leader and a couple of other team members could haul you into your meeting room and say, Scott Schindeldecker, your behavior has not been consistent with the Saturn philosophy. And so we're going to give you this piece of paper that describes the behavior changes that you need to demonstrate in the next 30 days. So you are out of the green zone and into the yellow zone, and you will sign this paper. 30 days from now, we will have evaluated your behavior over the past 30 days, and you will come in. When you go in 30 days later, if they say to you, your behavior has not been consistent, so we are giving you another piece of paper to sign, and you are now in the red zone. And if your behavior has not changed in the next 30 days, then you are subject to discipline. You are not allowed to have any union representation in the room during that proceeding. You're only allowed to have union representation after we have done to you what we're going to do to you, and then he'll be outside the door and you can do what you want. That's the consultation process. What did you do? It's behavior. What's in our contract? Your chairman or the union, jointly with the plant manager, now have the responsibility for efficiency in a plant and employee behavior. We don't put something like that in there unless you're going to be able to do something about it. So what I'm thinking is going to manifest itself maybe before the contract, but maybe during the contract and in it that you vote on, is a version of that consultation process. Nobody has to invent anything. It's all there's nothing new in the world. The problem is to think of it again. It's been done. It was done in 1985. Unimaginable, you might say. Well, unimaginable, you might say, with what's going on in the plants today 10 years ago, right? Just as unimaginable, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
They're doing it now. They're doing it now. I don't even get upset about it. I'm just telling it to you like a doctor says you got cancer. There's no more emotion behind what I'm saying than a doctor telling you you got cancer. You want to hoop and holler? You want to sit there and stare at me and think I'm insane? That's fine. When you're all done, let's get on with it.
Yep. Either going to live or you're going to die.
No, the fact is, you got it. We've got it now.
Right.
It's the next contract stuff is now happening. They just haven't fully operationalized that language that says the plant manager and the chairman or the representatives will have the responsibility for efficiency and behavior of employees. They've got a plan for that. It's in the contract. As I've said to you guys many times, all you got to do is get people pregnant with the idea. That's been sitting in that contract since it was ratified. Have they done anything with it yet? I don't know. You're in the plant. What has the chairman done about improving efficiency? Well, you call it continuous improvement in GMS. More and more work with less and less people.
Yep.
Continuous improvement is in GM, Ford, and Chrysler is really management by objectives. And you may not even remember that, but that was a big deal in terms of management systems. Management by objectives was you create an objective, create a project team, and then you calculate the return on investment in terms of what it costs you to have the project team and how much you're going to get back from the less people, more work deal. and that was called MBO. You can look it up on the internet. There were any number of books written about Manish Bhagchakarya. Nothing new here.
No. No. Just didn't think it was going to happen to us, you know.
Well, you say like it's happened already.
Right.
Continuous improvement is creating a hostile work environment. Mary Barr said we are going to squeeze every part of every penny out of every part of this organization that we can to increase our net margins. She didn't say we're going to sell more cars, we're going to be more competitive. She says, I'm going to squeeze the whole system for parts of pennies to increase my net profit, and I'm not going to be happy unless I get a 10% EBITDA in each quarter and at the end of the year. And she's doing it. Of course, she sold off all of her foreign subsidiaries. I mean, we've got operations in Canada, it's true, and in South America, but for all practical purposes, other than China, we've closed Africa, Europe, Germany, England, France, Russia. We've closed all that down.
Let me get Paul on, guys. Let me get Paul. Paul, you're on.
Oh, I just wanted to comment that, you know, Dick said there's nothing new. There is something new. Now we got a company union that cooperates with the process. When I hired in at Flint Truck and Bus 1978, if they added work to your job, you fought back. And you called a committee man, and he helped you get rid of the work. Now the union is helping management load you down.
But you still got that language in the contract for speed-ups. It's not going away.
It's not being enforced, and people...
Okay, so that hasn't changed.
Yeah.
It's all a carnival show. You know? Where is the peanut under the sewing thimble? Catch me if you can.
Right.
And, you know, you can talk about... Well, 30 years ago, it's pointless. The world today in those plants is like nothing any of us could have possibly. If anybody would describe the workplace in Ford, GM, or Chrysler today, whether you want to talk about percentage of temporary workers, the 8-year progression for tier twos, all the different pay rates, the continuous improvement, people who are paying union dues, who can get fired and they can't get union representation. If anybody would have told us that in 1979, 1980, we'd have called the paddy wagon for him and said, put this guy to rubber room. But this is the new normal. Why people talk about it's not normal. It's not right. It is the new normal for 140,000 people who work at Ford, GM, and Chrysler today. It is the new normal. Did I say it was right? No. I said it is the new normal. And if I say it ain't right, then I have to agree with you and say, but we didn't do it back then. And as far as it couldn't happen without the union, it went from the union looking the other way to the union being complicit in it with the corporation. To where now we have language in the GM agreement that says the plant manager and the chairman will be responsible for efficiency and behavior of employees. So the chairman in that plant that you worked in is now responsible for your behavior and your efficiency. For me personally, that's a violation of the National Labor Relations Act.
I would think.
Because that is a management function. That is a management function. And when a union assumes management functions, they can lose their status as a union under the act. But no point in trying to be pragmatic and rational about this, because there is no rationality to what's going on in these plants today. It is irrational. Yes, we have Article 2 in the Constitution. God, people have beaten that language to death. They've worn the sharp edges off all the words in Article 2. And it resulted in, well, what we have today. We have the National Labor Relations Act in addition to Article 2. We have the Labor Relations Act. We have all kinds of laws. But the reality of work life for the people who will punch in Monday morning is what's going on in there now. We can talk about it here tonight. It's not going to change it. It's like I told Scott. Doctor says you got cancer, you got 6 months to live. You throw a 5-minute histrionic fit. Finally, you run out of energy, and the doctor says, if you're all done now, let me tell you what we're going to do next. Because it's not going to change. You got cancer. So if you want to use cancer as the metaphor, we have a cancerous, destructive state in the plant for human beings today. That's the new normal. Nobody seems to care. When Lordstown and Orion happened, neither Detroit Free Press or the Detroit News wrote any stories about it. That's the pandering press in Detroit. I know about 5 reporters between those 2 papers, and I was going to call them up, but I didn't want to embarrass them. They were told there'll be no stories about it in the Detroit paper. And there were none. Of all the papers that should have published something about it, it would have been Detroit. I mean, the headquarters is right down the street from them, from the car companies. But not a peep, not a peep. General Motors says we're not going to publish our monthly sales quarterly anymore. Papers say, well, GM says they're not going to publish their sales. Nobody writes any criticism of that at all. Every quarter in the News and the Free Press, there used to be bar charts at the end of every quarter. Here's Ford, here's GM, here's Chrysler. In profit sharing, there used to be Pareto charts. Here's how my regular bar charts. Those disappeared. 4 years ago, I talked to a reporter I knew about 2 years ago. I said, why aren't you guys putting Pareto charts in? Not going to print them, Dick. So you don't get any charts showing numbers and comparisons. You get a lot of paragraphs that literally describe each company's profit sharing or sales in different ways. So it's hard to discern a comparison between the three. It's just the new normal, Paul. And we got a convention going on now, and we're going to get a new bunch. And as far as, boy, wait till you see what's in the 219 agreement. You're living the 219 agreement today. There'll be a couple of things they haven't institutionalized, such as what's going to be the language of how the plant manager and the chairman are responsible for efficiency and behavior. Are they going to do a cooperative operating agreement on that, maybe 2 months before the contract expires, like they did at Orion and Lordstown? Or are they going to wait and do it then? My guess is they're going to put a cooperative operating agreement on that language before the contract is negotiated. And all of us that worked for 30 or 40 years, 30 years or so ago, say, wow, this can't be. Well, Singledecker was there, and he's living it every day. Now, I mean, the human brain adjusts to its environment.
Let me break in for a minute. I can get Brian on. Tell me if you can hear this.
Well, get him on.
He's on Facebook right now. I mean, he's not talking.
Sounds like he's in the hallway or in that party.
Where's our photo op with Cindy Estrada? Is she still here?
No. They're over there.
We should go hand them a flyer. This is all their staff right here.
Yeah. Hello, everybody. I'm just going to be on here for a minute. I'm up here at the convention. Got my pass. It's in my pocket. Passing out the flyers. A lot of the international staff is walking around here. Just got done seeing Bob King and Cindy Estrada. So we're just going to kind of walk around, see where everybody's kind of going right now. Today was the day that everybody came in to register. Not too sure how much support I'll get, but either way, you guys have to live with these votes, the concessionary givebacks, the outsourcing of jobs, the corruption, possibly losing your health care in 2019 since they already got rid of your pensions. Anything's possible. So I hope you guys use common sense when you guys vote. So we're just kind of walking around. I think everybody went to the kitchen.
You got to see some of the new trends. Cindy and Bob definitely.
Yeah.
He didn't like that photo op.
Well, I got the pictures, so I'll post them.
Okay, now Scott's saying he's outside. Scott?
Yeah, I just sent you a live his live feed. He's outside. Looks like he's by a restaurant, maybe.
Where is it?
Well, there's no restaurants around Cobo Hall.
Where did you send the live feed?
I sent that to your wall. I sent that to you.
Oh, no. I don't know anything about this crap. Okay, I think I got it.
Yeah.
Talk to him. Hello, buddy.
What's going on, Matt? Hey, Dennis. Deb. Hey, Mike. Jeffrey. Hope you guys can hear me. So, anyways, I just want to give you an update. Basically, today, all the delegates just came in to register, and as they went to register, I met with some delegates. I passed out my flyers today. I do got my guest pass, just to let you guys know, because I know there was rumors spreading that I couldn't go to the convention. But like I said, I'm a union member in good standing. They couldn't keep me out, so... It's just trying to get people to, you know, just dish out the propaganda and try to sway the vote any way they can possibly do it. And, you know, I passed out a lot of flyers today. And so tomorrow I'll be here at 6:30 a.m. So we'll see what happens. I'll keep you guys informed every step of the way. And we'll see what happens. You know, I had a couple people trying to be cute, you know, come up to me, talk about, oh, I'm going to get with you tomorrow. We're going to do some Facebook Live. We got some questions to ask you. I mean, again, I don't care. You can ask me whatever questions you want. That don't intimidate me. So I'm already prepared for this. So outside of that, of course, it's raining. I hope the rain was going to hold off, but it's starting to rain here. But I'm going to try to approach some more delegates today, walking around through the downtown area and get my flyers out as much as possible. Like I said, I passed out my flyers during registration. I crossed Gary Walkowitz, didn't say nothing to me. I don't know where Leroy Leroy McKnight is. I didn't see him. I seen Cindy Estrada on Bob King. I didn't see Dennis Williams. So right now, Dennis Williams has got his retirement party going on. And like I told you guys before, your e-boards voted to buy a table at his retirement party, spending $1,000 on these tables. So anyways, outside of that, I'm going to let you guys go. I got a phone call. Talk to you later. Bye.
All right. There you guys go. Not much of an update, but there's not much to talk about, I guess.
Well, he's not even in the hall right now.
No, he's outside. Is that the one you were talking about, Scott?
Yes. Earlier, the one that you started before, he was inside the building.
Right. He was inside. Right.
So we're getting there. He's there. Got a lot on his plate. That's for sure. So,
I'd be interested to know how he got the pass. Did he get a delegate gets to have one guest pass. Every delegate. I'm wondering if he got a delegate to go and get a pass for him, or how he got the pass.
He's got one. Yeah,
what?
He's got one. That's all that matters. He's got one. That's all that matters.
Yeah.
So, I'm sure he'll be keeping people updated. Scott,
if you can text him, tell him to call the show.
Oh, he's not going to call a show tonight, I don't think, Don.
Yeah,
he's down there trying to get as much of his stuff out as he can.
I can try.
Leroy,
you got anybody in the switchboard, Don?
Yeah, there's a lot of people in the switchboard. Of course, they're not going to push one because you know how that goes. But, we have 40.
They're shy.
Pardon?
Yes. They're shy and afraid. 47 people in the switchboard.
Oh, you're kidding.
Push one on your keypad if you would like to say something, talk.
Yeah, say anything.
The UAW Factory Whistle Show. If you're, you don't even have to be a union. Just say hi.
Yes, there you go. The worker. I was going to ask Dick something. I mean, I get off the stuff what we got going here, but I seen that Marcioni was trying to expand his line of vehicles. He wants to give Maserati and Alfa Romeo, I guess, for all practical purposes, a high-end SUV like Cadillac.
Yeah, I saw that.
Lincoln.
He's gonna. If you want a Chrysler, an FCA high-end SUV. Then he's going to brand a Maserati or the other brand, Fiat, I think.
And they wouldn't be built here, right? They'd be all be built probably
no,
in Italy,
I
right?
think he's going to build them in Italy.
Okay.
And import them.
Right.
I think his main deal here is the Ram and the Jeep is what he's going to build here.
Right.
If I read the article right. It wasn't that specific, but he talked about that he was going to build them as those Italian brands. And I just assumed that meant he was creating work in Italy. Well, it sounded, I wouldn't even say I assumed it. I'm going to say it sounded like he's getting the SUVs the hell out of here. So you're either going to buy a Jeep because what, he's going to have a Jeep pickup. He's got the big Jeep four-door. And he's got the regular Jeep two-door, and then he's got the Ram. And those trucks, as you know, are more becoming four-door sedans than trucks anyway.
Right.
Oh, I know what I saw. They took a four-door Ram and prototyped a version of the truck as a Suburban. In other words, there was a picture of it on Facebook. I forget where I saw it, but it was dark gray, and all they did was extended the roof line out over the bed, and it looked like a Suburban with a Ram grill on it.
Kind of like the old Ram Chargers, kind of? Or that was
a Suburban,
right?
Take a truck and just extend the roof line over the bed. Bring that into the car. Move the door, split the doors like you do on a Suburban. Give it enough room so it's got three rows of seats.
Right. I mean, that's only going to compete with what? The Lincoln and or the Ford?
Well, it'll compete with our Suburban. It'll compete with the Navigator at Ford.
Right.
I mean, it's long overdue for him to do that anyway.
Yeah, he's been out of that market.
I mean, it's not like he has to build a new vehicle. All he's got to do is what we did with the Saturn with the four-door in 1994. When I was at Saturn, Skip LaFoe said, what do you think about extending the roof of the four-door and making it a station wagon? I said, well, let's don't call the kitty car a station wagon. Let's just say we're going to extend the roof and square and drop it down and call it a wagon, whatever. So I got them to take – we had a two-door coupe down at Saturn, but it was so small in the back seat. I said, why don't we make and the front seat, when I was really overweight, I said, I can hardly fit behind a steering wheel. I said, why don't we take the four-door and make it a two-door coupe and move the front seat back 2 inches? So we used to meet we got permission from GM to do that. And every Friday morning, we would meet at the GM Tech Center at the Saturn Design Studios, where they, you know, make them out of clay and have the full-scale drawings. Then we would approve the suppliers for the seats and all that stuff. And he said, we were in there one Friday morning, and he said to our chief engineer, he said, what success have you had? And he said, none. You're going to have to tell him. And I didn't know what they were talking about because the only people in the room were Skip LaFoe, me, Don, the vice president of marketing, and our head engineer. And we made all the decisions on what was going to happen in that car. And Skip says, Dick, we can't move the front seat back. I said, what the fuck are you talking about? We took a four-door, we're making it a coupe. Move the front seat back. He said, we can't. I said, why not? He said, because where the locator pins go into the underbody, that's where the seats get slid into. He said, Dick, we can't move the seats a 16th of an inch without redoing the assembly line. I said, so we went all this. You're going to take a four-door, make it a coupe. There'd be more room in the front seat, more room in the back seat. And now we can't do it because of the locator pins on the skittle on the assembly line. This is a true story. And he said, yeah. I said, all right, well, fuck it. And so they did. The front seat never got moved back. We sent that the prototypes off to clinics in San Francisco and New York and Dallas, Texas. And we did the marketing clinics, and then Hudler, the vice president of manufacturing, says, oh, they loved it. And I had to bite my lip with saying, yeah. And the front seat, which could be 2 to 3 inches farther back, is still where it always was. It's just the insanity of the car business.
Yeah.
Skip and I agreed we'd make a convertible out of that. So we had a full-scale drawing on the wall, side view of it, and a top view. I mean, a full-scale top looking down at the convertible. And I said, that is going to sell like hotcakes. We took the four-door sedan, and we're going to make it a convertible with a back seat. And then Roger Smith said, no way, we're not spending the money. That thing would have sold big time because there was no competition in the market. But we never got any farther than drawings.
Right.
Jeez, I forgot all about that when we started talking about it.
I seen something else that General Motors is doing. That they're going to work with Honda on a new generation battery.
That's a cover story for something else, Scott. Honda currently sells a fuel cell four-door. They're selling it in their showrooms, okay? Underneath that battery jargon is that Honda has the best fuel cell for an automobile in the world right now.
Uh-huh.
And Honda has agreed that we could use that fuel cell, and we're going to build the innards of it at the Brownstone battery plant where we're also going to do the batteries.
Gotcha.
So we'll be looking for a fuel cell. We're not making our own fuel cell. We just agreed we'd do the manufacturing for them here rather than them having to import them from Japan.
Right.
And in the interim, it's called patent trading. They agreed under their patent for their batteries that we would build the batteries for them and for ourselves, so we would get a superior battery. And part of that same deal is that we would build the fuel cells here at the Brownstone plant also. Because electric vehicles are nonsense. They've been a total waste of time and money. There was a fuel cell van at the tech center in 1967. A van that was driven with a fuel cell. Of course, not today's fuel cell, but a fuel cell. And I never understood why we even wasted our time with these lithium-ion batteries and all that nonsense when fuel cells are the way to go. You don't have a whole bottom plate full of a ton of batteries. All you got's the fuel cell and a hydrogen tank. So Honda's already selling theirs here now. Toyota's marketing a fuel cell car in Asia. They had them in Japan 2 years ago. So they're coming here. The problem you got is that Marchion is the smartest SOB out there. He didn't spend a goddamn nickel on this electric bullshit. Nothing. Because it's all going to wind up hydrogen fuel cells.
Right.
You don't need to make those batteries. I don't know what a battery pack weighs for crying out loud, but it's got to be more than 500 pounds.
I don't know. But he did do a crossover, hybrid crossover. He did the Pacifica.
He did that only for his corporate average gas mileage rating. If you got one car that you can get up to, say, 45 miles per gallon, that goes into the aggregate average of your CAFE standards. That's why GM and Ford always had a little car with high mileage that nobody wanted, but it was there if you wanted to, and that lowered their CAFE requirement. Don't forget, average. The CAFE standard is average over the fleet of your vehicles.
Right.
So what's happening now is we're in business with Honda now on fuel cells and their version of that battery. Right now, they haven't got the infrastructure, the people who mine the rare earth for those batteries, all the people who have been suppliers to the electric power business for vehicles have a vested interest in suppressing the hydrogen fuel cell coming to market. Honda's got them. Very few people even know they got them in their showrooms to sell. Because
right.
people come in, they say, well, I want an electric car. And all that, not electric cars are going to go the way of the horse and buggy. The fuel cell is here. The only problem
right.
is you can't get these states like Jerry Brown in California. His state's got hydrogen fuel stations all up and down the state now. But it's coming. And you don't have the problem with the fuel cells that you have with batteries in cold weather where they don't have as much amp hours and all that shit. All that shit goes away. Winter, summer, spring, or fall, you got the same power. You want to run your air conditioner, it doesn't matter. It's not going to run the battery down. And don't forget, in Wentzville, they made a fleet of mid-size pickup trucks for the Army with fuel cells in them. And the Army's
right.
got them now in the field and testing them.
Right. The ZR2 Colorado, ZR2.
Well, that's not what the Army's got. They got a fleet of cars made for the military with fuel cells.
Yes, it's a Colorado. They call it the
Yeah,
oh,
it's
no.
a Colorado. ZR, whatever engine, whatever fender flare, it's a Colorado with a fuel cell.
Yes, the ZH2, the hydrogen 2.
Whatever they're calling it, it's totally immaterial. The Army likes it for
right.
one reason. They can put that thing next to a tent, and they've got a power generator also.
Yep.
They've got electricity in the field all the time.
And they're working it, trying to figure out how they can capture the water and filter it so that it would be drinking water from the exhaust.
Well, I don't know how much water actually comes out of that exhaust. I mean, that's something I never thought about, but I don't think it pours water out of the exhaust. Unless it's maybe at
no.
a really hot temperature, eh?
No, they said that it was, I posted a while back ago on Workers, the article, and they had the fellow that represents the U.S. Army. And the gentleman and the fellow from General Motors, they were there when he got the first one. They took a road around the Warren off-road track, and they're talking about it. And they said if there's a way that they could collect the exhaust water and filter that and make that a potable water also. And they
well,
said
that's
they were
not
gonna
a
see
problem.
If they could... Right.
All they do is go up where it exits the fuel cell, put a spigot on there and a filter and then a tank. They ain't going to connect it out the back of the pipe. They'll connect it coming right out of the fuel cell.
Correct. So.
And just put a tank under there. I don't think it's going to be a prodigious amount of water, but it will be drinkable water. All you need is a charcoal
right.
filter.
Well, I mean, when you have no water, I mean, a liter of water is better than none. So.
No, I mean, I agree with that. I mean, it's a source of water, it's a source of electrical power, and it's a source of energy to drive a vehicle.
And that gets coupled with the technology that they've got right now with the fully autonomous hydrogen fuel cell platform on wheels, that's what it looks like.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw that.
That they could use.
You can
and,
drop anything on top of it.
Just about, you bet. And
well, I think what the Army's doing, I can't imagine two combat infantrymen sitting in the front seat of a Colorado truck. They may get them
right.
in, but how the hell are you going to get them out of there with all that crap
right.
they wear?
Right.
Those are kitty cars. I think they're just testing it to see if the platform will work.
That could be too.
And then what they can do for the larger vehicles, they won't change the vehicles to accommodate the fuel cell. They'll just make ever bigger fuel cells. If this one works fine under all conditions, then all they'll do is upscale the model. It's like an engine, you know, 100 horsepower, 300 horsepower, 500 horsepower, same engine. So my guess is they're going to test this fleet of trucks. If they hold up, if that fuel cell is made rugged enough, then all they have to do is upscale it. But they're not going to use them damn Colorado trucks at combat situations. They're little kiddie cars. They're just testing the fuel cell in the vehicle itself. And if they can upscale those fuel cells, they can drop them into ever bigger vehicles. And now they made the deal because Honda apparently has a better fuel cell than GM had. And now GM's got access to their current production fuel cell. And they're also going to make the rooftop units out of brownstone too. And then they're going to get their upscale battery. Well, that's good, hoop to hoop, because I think batteries go the way of the horse and buggy.
Interesting.
Totally inefficient way. I mean, it's efficient in terms of making the car go. But when you look at the added weight you give to the vehicle, the weight of the battery diminishes the battery's ability to drive the car ever more miles. It just draws more amps. Talking about batteries, I was at Home Depot. You know they've got battery-operated weed whippers, leaf blowers, lawn mowers, chainsaws. I couldn't believe it. I was looking at this Ryobi display, and every power tool they make uses the same battery. You don't buy a different battery. They're all the same battery. Whether you're buying a drill or a weed whipper or a leaf blower or a circular saw, they all use the same battery. Incredible.
Interchangeable.
Hell, I bought a weed whipper. No more mixing oil. No more pulling on a goddamn cord. None of that shit. That's all gone now. Just charge the battery and go.
Now, how does it work?
Works great. Are you kidding? Works fantastic. Out there pulling on that cord, draining the gas in the fall, hoping it'll start in the spring, swearing at the damn thing. Now all I do is take the battery put the battery in the charger overnight, put the battery in the weed whipper, and go whip. They've got about four different models. They all use the same battery. That's just the weed trimmers. They got a chainsaw on a pole. That uses the, for a tree trimmer, they put a small chainsaw at the end of a pole. And now DeWalt has brought out a line of weed whippers and blowers and circular saws and all that kind of stuff. But every tool that Ryobi makes uses the exact same batteries. There's three batteries. There's one they call a pancake battery that's the weakest power. Then there's a medium-sized one that's 4 amp hours. And then there's a large one that I think is 7 or 8 amp hours, but it's too big. I don't need it. I bought this damn weed whipper, and it cost me $100, and I got a pancake battery and a charger, and I paid $50 for the battery that's 2.5 times more powerful for it. So I got $150 and two batteries and this weed whipper, and it just works like a charm.
So that's what we're going to do with our cars, then, it sounds like. We're just going to change them around.
Well, I don't know about that, but I just got... I was in there, and I was looking at these things, and some guy had one in his buggy, and I was looking at this thing, and I thought, why should I go out there and screw around with them damn beasts? Why should I do that? And so I
right.
got a leaf blower and a leaf whipper for $99. Now, they had bigger blowers, but the point is, all that crap of, you know, that stabilizer for your fuel and take the gas out, and then you're pulling on a cord forever, that's
right.
done now. I love the thing. All I got to do is put the battery in and go. Anyway, that's got nothing to do with this show.
No. But battery, you know, it's all about the batteries again, you know. And that's where we're at with these vehicles. You say we're going to go hydrogen, not electric?
Well, Honda's already got, as I told you, for sale in America, a pure hydrogen-powered car. So it's coming. The reason it's not coming on fast is because, like, GM and Ford hasn't. Ford hasn't made a big investment in electric cars. And they're smart, like Marcioni. Only General Motors has got way out there ahead of itself on electric cars. They got a big investment in electric cars. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if Ford doesn't hook up with Honda or Toyota with a patent exchange or something like that and bring out hydrogen vehicles. It's just going to take some what appears to be insignificant event that, and the dam will break and hydrogen will be here, because now we're making these things in GM at Brownstone here in America for cars.
Right. Well, see what happens. I don't know. You know, with all this going on, the vehicles and them, you know, kind of working with other people to with the battery packs, Honda. But that's going to be mostly for Honda, but they'll have some rights to that. And like I said, they're working on the hydrogen fuel cell. They know that they want to do the trucks and heavy-duty trucks. They want to offer on a hydrogen truck platform also.
Well, General Motors does have experience with making the ones they did for the military. Now the issue is, the thing of it is, if whatever they're making is Honda's fuel cell, so if they wanted to make it bigger, then they're going to have to either make a deal with Honda or file a separate patent, but that's going to be difficult if the Honda fuel cell works so well, you can't copy any of it. Even if you want to
right.
make it bigger, you'd have to pay Honda a royalty on every fuel cell
right.
you make.
Right.
When I was at Saturn the first time with the Vice President of Engineering, Jay Wetzel, for designing the car for the launch, he was the greatest partner I had. He took me everywhere he went. And he said to me, we're going over to the tech center and we're meeting with Toyota. I said, why? He said, we're going to do a patent exchange. I said, what the hell is a patent exchange? He said, that's why you're my partner, Daniel. Come on, learn to be a vice president of engineering. We went over there and it took us 2.5 hours where they were negotiating a patent exchange. There were some things we had that they wanted and some things they had that we wanted. And so we did a legal, gave us legal patent rights. So what they had, and we gave them legal patent rights to what we had. He was a cool guy, this guy, Jay. I went to a number of these patent exchange meetings with them when we were getting the car ready for launch. It was some interesting stuff.
Oh, we'll see what happens. I don't know what's going on as far as the rest of this. How this is all going to play out with what we're doing right now. What happens at the convention is going to lead into our contract. Like you said, it's being played out right now.
Well, you know, we got a you remember Pat Meyer?
Yep. Yes.
She called me up the other day, and I said, you know, Patty, just forget about the convention going on right now. Whatever's going to happen there is going to happen there. Right now, anything you do around that convention, everybody's focused on the convention. Anybody that's there for other purposes, nobody's going to remember it after the convention is over because nobody's thinking about that. They're thinking about what's going on in the convention. So if you want to do something about the UAW, wait until a convention's over and you don't have the distraction of the convention going on to do it as you want to do. That's all.
Right.
I'm glad Brian got a pass. I am so happy he's going to be inside there finally watching what goes on in the convention. And if they decide to toot horns when Gary is talking, that's probably what Brian will remember. But I hope he absorbs the process of that convention. Don't
when
forget
is the election?
The election, I believe, is the second day.
Okay. Well, that'll be an interesting experience for them.
What is that?
I don't know.
It was something my computer did, I think, on its own.
The first day of the convention, they've got speakers that come in, that kind of shit. And then they've got business they want to take care of. You know, there may be, they've got a, the delegates each get two books. They're like 6x9 softcover books. One is a resolution book, and the other is the convention proceedings, the agenda, among all the other paper that's in front of them. But then they get a day's agenda. So when they come in, they'll get Monday's agenda. And there may be some changes they want to make in the Constitution. You're going to have a report of the convention appeals committee. Those are appeals under the Constitution that would normally have gone to the PRB that went to the convention committee. So there's two ways that appeals can be settled. The appeals committee will make their report. There's a couple of other committees that have to make reports. It's the drudgery of the business of the convention. Don't forget, what you got to look at the convention is this. Every month you have a union meeting in your local. Just prior to the union meeting, your executive board meets, and it transacts business. It approves the money that was spent, what they're going to buying a new rope, whatever the hell. Then what they did is submitted to the membership meeting that takes place shortly thereafter for approval. Well, the same thing happens at the convention. Only instead of an hour separating the action of the executive board, you got 4 years separating it because the actions that the executive board took are approved by the membership. The process is the same. It's just that it's 4 years difference. So any actions the executive board took that need to be approved by the membership will be approved. That'll be on the agenda Monday. And any changes they want to make to the Constitution will be there probably. And then when they come in Tuesday, they'll get another one-page agenda, and that will be the one, I believe, where they elect the officers. And then, of course, you've got the regents have to break off after they do that and elect the regional directors in their own private rooms. So, but I'm glad Brian got in there so he'll be able to see all that. And so I hope he's looking at the process of what's going on.
Yeah, it'll be a learning curve.
Whatever's going to happen there is going to happen there.
Right.
Now is not the time to be assumptive about it. It's just going to happen.
Right.
And whatever comes out the other end is what comes out the other end. There's no real it's not like New Directions is coming down on a convention and there's a big disruptive force out there.
Right.
Those were two conventions that shook the very foundations of Solidarity House.
Which one?
But Jerry Tucker brought the New Directions movement to town.
Yeah.
Those two conventions really, the footings of Solidarity House were vibrating in those two conventions.
Hmm. Almost really pulled it off. Almost.
Well, he did the second time. He got the region, but it didn't matter because.
Right.
But I mean, that was the only real time where the administration caucus was facing a real threat of losing. And don't forget, he was only running for regional director. He wasn't running for president.
No. But he got it, and then if I remember right, they dissolved the region, right?
No, that was region 2 and 2B.
Okay.
That was the guy that was in charge of region 2 was sympathetic to Tucker, and he was 65 at the time of the convention. And so Jokic just assumed, I think his name was Warren Davis, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that was it. He had a
and so Jokic, and he nominated his alternate regional director, or he said he was going to support his alternate regional director. But him and his alternate director, his name was Rich, he's a regional director now, made a secret deal. So when they went in a room and closed the door, nobody can be in that room but the delegates. None of the UAW officers can be in that room. That is a closed election among the delegates. It's their election. It's their regional director. So they come out of there, and everybody assumes since Warren Davis was 65, he wasn't going to run. But he turned the tables on Jokic, and he ran, and he got elected, even though he was 65. There's no law saying you can't run at 65 for anything. There's no law at all. Under the laws of our land, it's age discrimination of any organization prohibits you from doing anything because of your age. It's just been a cultural accepted kind of a thing in our tribal village. So Warren Davis comes out of there, and he's the regional director. Jokic has a heart attack. And all night long, he's up in his penthouse with his group. So we come downstairs the next morning, and he takes the microphone. He said, never mind the agenda that you have. And he announced that the executive board has met, and as a cost-saving item, they were going to combine Region 2 and 2B, and 2 was going to be folded into 2B. And headed up by the guy who was elected to 2B. So Warren Davis was there to be the regional director of nothing. He did that overnight. And, of course, the delegates supported what he wanted. So I witnessed that one. That was quite an astounding move. And only Jokic would have done that, something like that. Because he didn't care. He was not going to be snubbed. He was not going to have his power challenged by anybody, including God. And So I was there for that one. And I was there for the two Jerry Tucker things. But those are the only two things. Other than that, the conventions have been pretty boring, and the hand went around the clock without interruption, and then the convention was over.
Wow.
It doesn't matter who got up and said what at the microphones and all that stuff. And as a staff, our job was to put them papers out every morning. We made the victory signs up. We would meet at 5:30 in the morning the day before the election, and we put all the placards together and blew up all the balloons with air so they could fall out of the ceiling, and put noisemakers on the table, put the agendas out, whatever other paper they had to have. And then the youngest member on the staff, they were all, and I don't mean in GM, I mean the whole UAW, they were the sergeant-at-arms. The lowest seniority guys were all the sergeant-at-arms. The door guards, the gate guards, all that stuff. And once we did our job in the morning, we were free to do what we wanted. But nobody could be on that floor. And the reason for that is that you may be there and it could and vote accidentally or be counted accidentally. And it's the same thing in union hall. Nobody belongs in your union hall who doesn't have the right to vote. I don't care who it is. From the region, from the international. They got no business once that gavel hits and the meeting is adjourned. In that room. That's just not for the convention.
You think they've changed the language on that? Because as you know...
No, I know what's going on. I know. I hear the stories about the local unions. It's no different
right.
from the plant and the kind of representation they're getting. The people who run the local unions is just as screwed up as the people who are getting screwed in the plants. We're so far away from what it's supposed to be, it's not worth talking about.
Correct.
Doesn't do us any good to talk about it. The people in the plants are too scared to do anything about it, so forget it. And I don't blame
right.
them. I'd be scared, too. If I could get fired in any given instant by any member of management and I don't get any union representation, I just paid $42 out of my check for union dues and I'm getting fired an hour later and I can't get a committee man to represent me.
Right.
I don't know why the NLRB and the Department of Labor has not descended on us like a herd of tanks on that one.
I was just going to say, how can that even be legal that you pay for
I just said that. I said it in another way, Paul. I agree with you.
Yeah.
But it shouldn't take anybody to contact them. They know it. It's in the contract. All these contracts go to the Department of Labor. They are read by the legal staff in the Department of Labor. The business about the chairman being responsible for your efficiency behavior, that would not hit a lawyer upside the head. The part about temporary workers will not be provided union representation if they're fired, and that management doesn't even have to give a reason. Of all the labor laws, the Labor Management Relations Act, Taft-Hartley, National Labor Relations Act is amended, and yet there it sits in the contract, and the Department of Labor and the National Labor Relations Board is silent as a lamb. I don't know. I thought I understood some of these laws, but For $47 a month, I get nothing. and I don't get what other people get. Under paragraph 6, it says, employees will not be discriminated against for union membership. So I go to my foreman, I say, well, my committee man, the foreman says you can't have him, you're a temporary worker. Am I not being discriminated against under paragraph 6? Silence.
No, no silence. You're right. But
there's no
there is language.
They put it in there, well, and they're getting away with it. That's it.
And they shouldn't be.
Well, I probably agree with you, but the point is, for you to say they shouldn't be getting away with it, and me to say they shouldn't be getting away with it, it's the doctor with the cancer metaphor, but they are.
Right.
That's what I was saying to Paul. 30 years ago, if you'd have told anybody, 25 years ago, you can be working in a plant, you can be paying union dues, and you're not allowed to have union representation under the terms of the national agreement, and you're paying dues. People would have said, you guys are all crazier than bedbugs.
Correct.
Well, we wouldn't have believed that they were going to institutionalize work speed up either. That
I understand.
Union endorsed.
Right.
It is so insane now and irrational. I mean, I'm not going to go to negative adjectives. There's no point in it. But it is irrational and insane. One doesn't even know where to begin to even try and explain it to somebody.
Right.
Well, it's insane that they think they can take that program and organize other plants out of the union. They don't have anything.
Well, they're sure doing it.
Yeah.
And if you think it's any different in the Teamsters or in a Steelworkers Union or SEIU or even in these casino workers or the 70,000 teaching assistants we got, all this morphs into those agreements also. Don't forget,
right.
Paul, back, oh, let's see, I went in 63. By 67, everybody I knew was after me to get them a job in General Motors. Everybody wanted to go into the factory. I forget when we started getting $10 an hour. It had to be somewhere around 67. I think just before 1970. But 10 bucks an hour. And everybody now wanted to go into the factories. We were making more money than teachers, police officers, if I remember right. When we hit 10 bucks an hour, we were probably the highest paid non-college graduates in Michigan. Especially when you figure in overtime and stuff. But our perks, our AIF, our COLA, in 1973, we got the PPH days. We got free stock based on the number of hours we were working. And everybody I knew, how could I get into plant hog? I said, just go. I don't know. There was no Michigan Works kind of filter in those days. I mean, there was a lot of those plants that were selling jobs. I hope you guys know that. I mean, back in the 60s, there were a lot of plants that were selling jobs. And it was between some salaried guy who was assigned to hourly personnel in administration and some union politician. Hell, I had a shop committeeman. We were sitting in a bar we used to drink in called Ed's Garage. It was up over a slaughterhouse in Hamtramck. And I was the district committee man at the time at skilled trades. And this guy was a skilled trade guy.
a white guy on second shift. He was on the shop committee. And he was from West By God, Virginia. And he was sitting there, and I always sit as far away from that guy as I could. And he opens up his briefcase and shows the guy from Dodge, Maine, because some of the guys from Dodge, Maine on Joseph Compo came to Hamtramck to drink. And there was a shop committee guy from Dodge, Maine. He said, "Oh, yeah, hell, I got a pad of applications right here." And I heard that word application. I saw that 8x11 pad he had. And the big guy I knew from Dodge, Maine, I was about 8 stools away. He said, "Hey, Dick, you need an application for anybody to go to work at Chevy Gear and Axle?" And this guy Brown grabs the pad away. He said, "Be quiet about that." I said, "Brown, you got a pad of applications for jobs at the Gear and Axle?" He said, No. And a guy, he was a big, heavyset guy. He was laughing like a big Santa Claus. He said, "Goddamn right he does, Danson." I said, "Jesus Christ, Brown, you're in the wrong bar. Why don't you go over to Club Polski or the Blue Goose or Port Bar and sit down at a table of women and see how many you want to take to bed tonight. You don't need a bag of grass for this one." So I know that was going on in my plant, and then I found out that he was walking around with an application, because on there it said recommended by. But I mean, right. I didn't give any thought to, you know, FBI or any of that kind of stuff. It didn't matter, because the next election I beat him anyhow, and he went back to work.
We have 2 minutes left, or just less than 2 minutes.
Yeah, we haven't done much here. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Scott. You wrap it up.
There will be a show next week. Even though it's Father's Day, hopefully we'll have maybe Scott Holdefin and Brian Keller on and tell us what happened.
Yeah, let's try and get them to come on the show and tell it. And let's all be quiet and let them tell us what happened at the convention.
Right.
I think that's what we should do next week.
Right, and do like an hour show, and then, like I said, let them explain what happened.
Yeah, I'm gonna encourage Scott Holderson to come on the show and give us a synopsis of what happened.
Okay.
So you can encourage you encourage Brian.
Gotcha.
Next week, an hour.
Well maybe it'll go longer depending on what they're saying. You know, who knows.
All
right. True. Normally, on the holidays and stuff, we don't do a show, but this is special here, and we'll go from
there. I think it's important. We got two guys who ought to be willing to come on and tell us what they saw.
Yep. I agree.
I mean, if somebody's got to go barbecue, then they can go. That don't mean... if those guys are willing to sit and tell us about it and the people are going to upload the show, that they shouldn't hear it.
Right.
I agree. So with that being said, I guess we're going to be seeing everybody next week. We'll try to get Brian and Scott on the show and give us what happened. Don?
Yes.
Sound good to you?
Yeah.
All right. So with that being said, about 30 seconds, I guess in advance, we'll say Happy Father's Day to the people. I'll say it again next Sunday, too. But if you don't make it, Happy Father's Day. And I hope you enjoy your time with your family.
All right.
Being said, we'll see everybody next week at 7.
Good night, Paul. Good night, Dick. Good night, Scott.
Good night.
From the J.W. 3 Whistle Show.